Caboo Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor Top Dog Underdog, running Friday, November 9th at the Chapel Theater in Milwaukee. Top Dog Underdog tells the story of a sibling rivalry between African-American brothers in a turbulent relationship punctuated with dark humor. Their names are Lincoln and Booth. This show has adult content and is not recommended for children. Again, that's Top Dog Underdog, running Friday, November 9th at the Chapel Theater, 4107 Southeast Harrison Street in Milwaukee. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Coming up next on KBOO, Art Focus talks to curator Mary Beth Graybill about the Portland Art Museum's show Poetic Imagination in Japanese Art. KBOO programming is made possible by KBOO member listeners and support from Portland 5 Centers for the Arts, presenting Mystery Science Theater 3000 live, Friday, November 9th at Arlene Schnitzer Concert Hall, featuring The Brain at the 7 p.m. showtime and Deathstalker 2 at 10 p.m. More information is online at portland5.com.
Hi there. You're listening to Art Focus on KBOO-FM 90.7 Portland Community Radio. My name is Eric Bartels. On October 13th, Portland Art Museum raised the curtain on an exhibit called Poetic Imagination in Japanese Art. Most of the works in the exhibit have never been seen by the public. Our guest today is Mary Beth Graybill, who is the Arlene and Harold Schnitzer Curator of Asian Art for the Portland Art Museum and the curator of the exhibit. Mary Beth, welcome to the show.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
I wonder if most people have no more than a vague impression of Japanese art, and if that impression sort of starts with very muted colors, very precise brush strokes, quiet, contemplative, maybe even a little somber. Is that accurate?
I think I'm no longer in any position to say what most people think of Japanese art, but in the field, our sense is that the form of Japanese art that's best known to Americans is Japanese prints. And the one name that most Americans are likely to know is Hokusai, who was the great master of landscape prints, and we associate him with those wonderful prints of Mount Fuji. And it's not just Americans. Japanese prints began to be imported to the West, especially in France. There were certain champions of Japanese prints, Edmond de Goncourt and others. But artists like Manet, Degas, were known to collect Japanese prints, and you clearly see the influence of Japanese prints in Impressionism. So for many Westerners who value anything non-Western in terms of its impact on Western art, I would say that prints is the point of entry. And we did a major exhibition of Japanese prints from our own collection in 2011. Japanese paintings are far less commonly collected in the West. You can buy prints easily. There have been many dealers specializing in prints since the early 20th century, and you can frame a print and put it on your wall in your house. But Japanese paintings come in formats, that means a sort of shape, designed specifically to fit Japanese architecture. So if you have a hanging scroll, that in Japan would go into an art alcove, a recessed niche, which protects it from children and other flying objects. Or it might be a screen that you would put up to, you know, demarcate a particular space, or a hand scroll. And none of these work well in an American domestic interior. So that's one impediment. The second is that historically there have been far fewer dealers, so people have had less access that way. And then the last, I think, is that if we were to enumerate American museums with major collections of Japanese painting, we would need all of our fingers and toes, but still, in many parts of the country, they're not accessible.
The subtitle of the exhibit is Selections from the Collection of Mary and Chaney Coles. I'm sorry. Who are those people?
Mary and Chaney are a couple in Seattle, Washington, that we, by which I mean the Portland Art Museum, have known from prior to my arrival at the museum in 2007. For many years, Chaney Coles operated a gallery of Asian antiques in Seattle called the Crane Gallery, and a lot of Portlanders would go there. And at his gallery, he sold a wide variety of ceramics and textiles at generally pretty affordable prices. So the gallery was quite separate from his own personal collecting. And Chaney, the husband, is the one who's driving the collecting. And he had been previously well known as a collector of Chinese paintings. But he tells a wonderful story. In the late 1990s, he joined a trip that the Seattle Art Museum organized for its Friends of Asian Art to Japan. And in Kyoto, Paul Berry, who had been, I can't remember whether he was still then, teaching at the University of Washington, took them around to various dealers. And he saw this painting. It's a quick, humorous little ink sketch. It's the very first thing you see in the exhibition of a low-ranking samurai who's kind of jogging down the road, essentially shouting, clear the way, clear the way. And next to it is this poem. And they're both done with this marvelous, light, humorous touch. He didn't know who the artist, he didn't know what the calligraphy said, but he loved it and he bought it. And as he tells it, that painting is what sort of became the occasion for a resurgence and an older interest in Japanese art. And since then, he's been an insatiable collector.
Now, why is it? Is it unusual that this collection, that the pieces in this collection were never seen? Was there no one saying, may we please sort of, will you loan us these pieces? Can we do an exhibit?
Well, I have borrowed a few things from the collection in the past, and the Seattle Art Museum has borrowed a few things in the past. I think that the reason that they haven't been seen otherwise is that the Coles are intensely private people, and very few people knew about the collection. And it's only really been in the past, I would say, 5 years that curators from around the country have been making regular pilgrimages to their home in Seattle.
Because there's been some kind of renewed interest in Japanese art?
It's not so much that. It's that, again, the Coles were not interested in advertising to the world that they had these works. We got to know about it because we were regularly going to Seattle, and we would go to the gallery, and at some point he said, well, you know, I have Japanese paintings too, you can come to the house. And it was that kind of very, and very typical of him, this very humble, casual, you know, I have some paintings, and his warm invitation to us. So I think that some collectors and some scholars in Seattle and us, we knew about it. And in others, it was a case of whether or not you knew. There are two scholars in particular that Chaney has worked closely with. One is Paul Berry, whom I mentioned earlier, who had got to know the Coles when he was on the faculty at the University of Washington. And I don't remember the year that he left, but he has, at least for the last two decades, lived in Japan. And he himself is an avid collector. And he's the sort of person who goes around to the galleries and the dealers in Kyoto probably more than once every month to sort of see what's there. And as he got to know the Coles better and better over the years, what he would do is he would, if he found things that he thought would be of interest, that he knew would sort of tick the boxes, he would send Chaney photographs and information. And so that's been a very good partnership, wonderful partnership for them. So And then the other person is a woman who's an independent scholar. She got her PhD from Paul Berry at Washington, Michio Morioka, who's a specialist in 20th century painting. And she has been helping the Coles all along in terms of creating a bilingual catalog of the collection, because actually the Coles don't read Japanese. But it's very much, I would say, Cheney Coles' taste that makes a decision about what comes into the collection.
So Poetic Imagination is a huge coup for you and for the Portland Art Museum. There must be people across the country or around the world that are interested in seeing a collection of this size that includes so many works that have never been seen publicly.
It is a coup for us. There have been many museums that have, especially as the sort of secret got out, have been assiduously wooing the Coles. It's a tremendous privilege to be the first to present an exhibition of the collection.
What kind of feedback have you, I mean, at this early stage in the sort of run of the exhibit, what are you hearing from people, or have there been any surprises?
I think there actually hasn't been time for the scholars to get here, and they may be waiting until we have our symposium, which will be feature all of the speakers who contributed to the catalog. So we have an international team, actually, of 6 people that contributed to the catalog. And so they may be waiting for that moment to come so that they don't come twice.
And while we're on it,
yes.
Is that something that's going to be available to museum members or the general public? And when does that happen?
Yes. Our website needs to be updated a bit, so I would caution visitors to maybe wait towards the latter part of the week from this announcement. But the symposium will be Friday night, December 7th, and all day Saturday, December 8th. And for the general public, $35 registration gives you admission to not only the symposium, but the museum all day from Friday through Saturday of that weekend, Friday through Sunday of that weekend.
Let's go back to the art itself.
Okay.
A little bit. And that idea that maybe there are misconceptions around Japanese art. You mentioned the opening piece, this little sort of throwaway. I don't want to call it a throwaway. The sort of lighthearted,
casual sketch, yeah.
Is there not more of that in the exhibit than some people might expect? And by that I mean sort of different approaches to the art, sort of less serious takes on sort of traditional art of its kind.
I think that for the non-specialist, that there will be a lot of surprises in the show. Many exhibitions of Japanese art, most exhibitions of Japanese art, will draw the boundaries of the scope more narrowly. So there have been a number of exhibitions from private collections in recent years at museums across the country that have focused on one historical period. Most often it's going to be the Edo period, essentially 17th through mid-19th century. Or there might be an exhibition that focuses on ink painting of the medieval period, 14th through 16th century. Or an exhibition might focus on a particular theme, such as paintings dealing. There's going to be a major exhibition coming up at the Met on paintings dealing with the tale of Genji. By choosing Poetic Imagination as the topic, we were extremely ambitious in the chronological scope. The exhibition goes from 844 to 1986. And it includes calligraphies. And I think that if we had done just the 15 examples of calligraphy alone, that it would be an exhibition worth traveling halfway around the world to see. And it would have been a stunning surprise to most of the people who come, because there are things there that sort of meet your expectations and things there that defy your expectations.
Okay.
And in terms of paintings, there's extraordinary variety, and that variety unfolds as you go through the exhibition. It unfolds in terms of the artists and the consumers. And one of the things that I like to say about the works in the exhibition is part of what makes them poetic is their association with a body of literature that is shared knowledge amongst the producers and the consumers. So we have the works in the exhibition being an expression of being part of a group, part of a group that has shared history, shared education, shared values, but that group, as you go through the exhibition, constantly expands.
There are a number of artists in the exhibit who are described as avant-garde. And so there are a number of pieces, and not just from more recent times. In various time periods, you'll see expressions that seem not out of keeping, but sort of maybe beyond what the average person expects somehow. They're playful, sort of rapid brush strokes, and works that were not exacting in the way of some of the things we associate with Asian art. Is that fair? And now I'm probably reflecting my lack of knowledge about, obviously there, throughout the history of any culture, there are going to be people with different ideas about any kind of art. Maybe it just seems surprising to me because of what little we know of Asian art.
I think that you're picking up on works that incorporate, on the one hand, stylistically spontaneity.
Color, bright color.
And bright color, but also a sense of play. And one of the things I didn't call attention to it in and of itself in this exhibition, but play, I think, is one of the major characteristics, actually, of Japanese art. Not all works, not all schools, not at all times. But I think that Japanese art actually has a playfulness that's unique to Japanese culture. And that can come in many ways. So, for example, in that very first work that we talked about, it's actually by a nun, Otagaki Rengetsu. And as I say, Cheney Coles didn't know that when he bought it. She turns out to have been an extraordinary celebrity in her own time, a person who became a nun out of really quite tragic circumstances. She'd lost two husbands to death. She lost her children to death, became a nun. But she, instead of going into retreat, she supported herself by making calligraphy and ceramics. But there's, if you look at the style of her work and if you look at the style of her calligraphy, there is this sense of joy and lighthearted generosity and warmth in her calligraphy itself, and you can certainly get that. But there are other works. I think that one of the pieces you may be thinking of is there's a spectacular work of calligraphy by Japan's most famous Zen monk, Ikkyu, who lived in the 15th century. He was the unacknowledged offspring of an imperial emperor, became a Zen monk, and he ignored all of the rules. He was often drunk. He had a mistress. He criticized his elders, but he rose to become the head of one of Kyoto's most important monasteries, and he was greatly revered by both his lay patrons and his disciples. And when a Zen abbot does a work of calligraphy, that is going to be something that is highly sought after by his disciples and fans, because calligraphy is the direct mark of the person on the paper. It's sort of the most immediate communication, intimate communication you could have with the artist. And so you have a sense of it's their personality, their untrammeled personality, undisguised personality there on the paper. And in his case, it's this crazy, exuberant calligraphy that sort of explodes. And you really get a sense of his eccentric and unique personality.
We learn in the exhibit of this meeting of calligraphy and art and poetry. Is it different in some way from other cultures, that sort of meeting of different genres of art or expression?
That connection between poetry and painting is also very important in China. And there is an entire section in the exhibition called Literati Culture, which is very much inspired by Chinese models. That's a phenomenon, the literati school, if you want to call it a painting, is a phenomenon of mid-18th to early 20th century in Japan. And these are artists who, by choice, look to Chinese culture, Chinese models, and they're reading Chinese poetry. They're inspired by the themes in Chinese poetry, and they're looking at Chinese paintings. And but I think that in Japan, what this exhibition shows is that the nature of that relationship evolves over time, and it's, I would argue that it's broader in Japanese history, because you have more groups. In China, this connection between poetry, calligraphy, and painting is, it's the private world, if you will, of highly educated upper class of scholar officials. And in Japan, sooner or later, everybody gets in on the act. So there's greater variety and, I think, greater freedom of artistic expression.
In Japan, as anywhere, art is going to reflect the culture around it. What can you say in sort of a general way about the manner in which some of the pieces in the exhibit do just that, and maybe at various times? Is there a particular time period where, for you, the art is very telling, the what you're looking at is very, reveals much about the culture of the time?
We've set up the exhibition in four sections that, not necessarily the artwork, but the origin of the concept unfolds in a chronological sequence. And also four different contexts in which we see this relationship between poetic inspiration and the visual image. The first section in the exhibition is called Waka and the Courtly Tradition. Waka means Japanese poetry. That's a direct translation. For the most part, we're talking about the kind of verse that has 31 syllables. And this is fairly familiar to some Americans through lots of translations, but 31 syllables. And this is a tradition deeply associated with the imperial court in Japan. And that the imperial court is kind of at the center of government through about the end of the 12th century. But in this small, narrow society, aristocratic society, in which women also are full participants, maybe at the most 1,000 people alive at any one given time, poetry is a fundamental way that they communicate with one another. And that's partially because this is like the French court at its height. It's a place where language is a language of decorum. So poetry is indirect. You don't say, "Why haven't you been to see me for 3 weeks? I'm really miserable." You say, "The path to my door is covered with weeds." And that's a lament about love having faded away. So it's a language that is used to express both casual but also the most profound of emotions, but very often indirectly and briefly and through suggestion. And the imagery that comes out of that is of multiple kinds, but the first is writing of poetry on beautiful paper. And we have some examples that are, one is from the Heian period, a 12th century calligraphy, but we have a number of examples that are from a 17th century revival of court culture. And one of those is written by an emperor himself. The other thing is that the other type that comes out of waka culture is portraits of poets, and those are normally done by initially members of the aristocracy, and they make them as icons. If you venerate a portrait of a great poet, you can acquire some poetic skills. It's really analogous to making a Buddhist icon and acquiring religious merit. It's direct parallel. And that's an art style that begins, people in the court do it, but then professional painters do it for wider audiences. And then the final art form that comes out of that is an image that reflects the emotive or narrative content of the poem. And so we have works in that section of the exhibition that are 20th century, when the poems that were originally composed at the Imperial Court are now part of every grade school education, and what had once belonged to a very small, narrow group is now the possession of the entire nation. So that's one example. The second section is about the Zen milieu and ink painting, and the calligraphies and the ink landscapes and the grapes and the herons in that exhibition is a tradition that originates inside of the monasteries. Zen is a sect of Buddhism that originates in China and comes to Japan in fits and starts, but really becomes the dominant form of Buddhism in Japan from the 14th century forward. And major monasteries in Kyoto operate like universities of Chinese studies. So if you are a monk, or if you are a serious lay patron of the monasteries, you're going to be reading Chinese history and Chinese poetry as well as Buddhist texts. And the inspiration for what they do is imported Chinese paintings and calligraphies from the 12th through 14th centuries. So that's the ink tradition. But when you move into a later time period, when you have military aristocracy that essentially is running Japan, that's pretty much the case really from 1185 onwards. But in the Edo period, you have wealthy military aristocracy, and they want a piece of that culture. And so now you have professional artists working in those ink styles for a much broader market. I'm sort of building this pattern of markets expanding.
Sure.
Okay.
And sort of increased access in a way.
Absolutely, increased access.
That it became
access.
More of a popular or sort of available to a broader population.
A broader audience, absolutely.
I wonder, you're a person with long history and great expertise. You've been looking at Asian art, Japanese art for a long time. Is it still possible for you to say, what is it that the average person is going to experience looking at the kinds of works that are in poetic imagination that differs from European traditions or African traditions or perhaps, you know, forms of art that Americans are maybe more familiar with? Is there a piece of the experience that sort of marks it as distinct? Is it possible to answer that question?
Not in the time we have in the interview. but I think, I was thinking as I was coming in, you know, there are many ways to approach this exhibition for people with many levels of experience and familiarity with Japan. I think, although I am, of course, biased, that it's one of the most beautiful exhibitions we've ever mounted. So I think that for the person with no familiarity and no interest in Japanese culture, qua Japanese culture, will be blown away by the sheer variety and exuberance of the works that are on view. I think that for the person who has some familiarity with Japanese culture, varying from having read about it in a high school history textbook to having traveled to Japan once or twice, that the breadth of the work in the exhibition will be astounding. Because you go from, in the Zen monochromatic paintings, for example, works that are very elusive and very suggestive and require 5 minutes of looking before you can even make out what's there. So that's the kind of work where you would love to sit in front of it on a little, you know, mat and sort of contemplate. And at the same time, there are works in this exhibition that bound off the page with energy and exuberance and joy. So I think that the variety of experiences and the encounters with beauty will be what is appealing to the general audience.
Our guest today on Art Focus has been Mary Beth Graybill, Arlene and Harold Schnitzer, curator of Asian art at the Portland Art Museum. She is the curator of an exhibit called Poetic Imagination in Japanese Art, opened on October 13th. Will run through January 13th of next year. Mary Beth, thank you very much.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Art Focus on KBOO FM 90.7, Portland Community Radio. My name is Eric Bartels.
Tune in to KBOO Tuesday, November 6th from 6 to 10 p.m. for election night coverage. We'll have national coverage by Pacifica and Native Voice One. And at 8 p.m., our local news team will provide election results and analysis. Again, that's election night coverage Tuesday, November 6th, starting at 6 p.m. after the KBOO Evening News here on your community radio station, KBOO Portland.
I don't know if I know all the words or not, but I'm going to try to sing it for you.
In celebration of our 50th anniversary, KBOO is teaming up with the Mississippi Records Music and Film Series. KBOO will be hosting Wild in the Streets on Wednesday, November 7th at 7:30 p.m. at the Hollywood Theater in Portland. A freaked-out 60s exploitation movie, Wild in the Streets follows Max Frost and the Troopers, a psychedelic rock band that managed to take over the United States after the voting age is lowered to 16. The new regime legalizes all drugs, puts everyone over 30 into acid re-education camps, and creates a new hippie fascist utopia. Again, that's Wild in the Streets on Wednesday, November 7th at 7:30 p.m. at the Hollywood Theater in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.